From the KBIA newsroom in Columbia, this is Intersection, Conversations in Our Community. I'm Sarah Shariari. This week, we talk with Clarence Lang, professor of African and African American Studies at the University of Kansas. He's also an MU grad. Clarence is author of Grassroots at the Gateway, Class Politics and Black Freedom Struggle in St. Louis, 1936 to 75, and of Black America in the Shadow of the 60s, Notes on the Civil Rights Movement, Neoliberalism, and Politics. Clarence came to Columbia earlier this month to give a lecture, and we sat down with him beforehand to talk about his work and what makes St. Louis and the state of Missouri such an important place to study civil rights. Here's our conversation. You wrote a book called Grassroots at the Gateway, Class Politics and Black Freedom Struggle in St. Louis from 1936 to 1975.
That's correct.
Can you tell me a little bit about the book and why you chose that time period?
I was really interested in a few things. I was interested in better understanding the major African-American social movements of the 20th century and the role of working people in those movements, and how social movements became a place where Black communities not only fought discrimination or racism, structures of inequality, but also how those battles to improve the conditions of Black people overall in society sparked struggles even within Black communities on the basis of class. And the period between the 30s and the late 1970s, I thought was a good moment because this was a period where, on the one hand, the emergence of an activist federal state emerged out of the Great Depression and the New Deal and World War II. And in the late 1970s, that's the period, at least that I argue, where that infrastructure and even popular ideas about the role of the national government and civil society began to change and consequently were rolled back. So the 30s, that 40-year period, I thought was pivotal in understanding both the development of progressive, if you will, social democratic social policy, or as close as we got to it in the United States. And on the other end, it was bookended by the beginning of efforts to scale that back.
So when we talk about this progressive social policy, we're talking about the New Deal and the idea that the government should help people get to work, and the period until the government was sort of retrenched as less of a provider of jobs, essentially?
As a problem, in fact. Mm. I mean, that became the mantra in the 80s, that government doesn't help. It gets in the way. So the less that government does, the better. But that was also the period, the 30s to the 70s, where because I was also wanting to understand the role of Black social movements in helping to create this modern activist federal state. So it wasn't simply the Social Security Act. It wasn't simply agricultural policies or banking policies, but also the emergence of a strong national trade unionism that was complicated and weakened, I would argue, by gender and racial discrimination, but nonetheless provided a space for Black working people to organize, even as they did so in their communities. So it's also, in some ways, the story of the rise and fall of big labor, as well as what people would call today big government.
This is Intersection on KBIA 91.3 FM. And today we're talking with University of Kansas professor Clarence Lang about race, organized labor, civil rights, and why Missouri is such important ground for study. Clarence is author of Grassroots at the Gateway, Class Politics and Black Freedom Struggle in St. Louis, 1936 to 75.
The central narrative is about the activism, the lives, the experiences of Black working people, but it's also in some ways secondarily a story about ideas of social welfare in the United States and the role of government in that, and how working people played a role in helping to expand the meanings of citizenship and democracy across the board, not just for Black people or not just for working people. I think, for example, the Black trade union leader, A. Philip Randolph, who was the president of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, which was an organization that represented railroad labor, porters.
Was it the Pullman Porters?
The Pullman Porters.
Uh-huh.
That was his organization. And while that group was obviously involved in seeking to improve the pay, the working conditions, opportunities, even opportunities for respect for Pullman Porters, it would be a mistake to simply reduce the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters simply to that. That is to say, this was an organization that was active between the 20s up until the early 60s in the major movements encompassing Black communities. So it was more than just simply a trade union organization. It also functioned as a civil rights organization. And in fact, that organization, the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, was pivotal in an effort to, in the context of the Second World War, the March on Washington movement.
Mm.
This emerged out of demand on the part of African-Americans during the Second World War for more opportunities, access to better jobs in the war industries during the Second World War in the midst of war production. And they had planned to stage a militant protest in the nation's capital. And that was averted only because the president at the time, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, signed Executive Order 8802, which outlawed discrimination, not just on the basis of race, but also national origin, religion, and the war industries, and created the Fair Employment Practice Commission as a watchdog agency to oversee that. Do you see what I mean? So this was an organization that had an impact beyond simply the lives and working conditions of its members. And in fact, this same group, the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, and I keep saying it because a lot of people have not heard of A. Philip Randolph or of this organization. They were one of the organizers of the 1963 March on Washington. And it's not only until that point that Martin Luther King Jr. becomes the national civil rights figure that we think of today. Up until that point, it was A. Philip Randolph, not King, who was associated with the rights of labor, but also with civil rights as well.
So there's really, in this sense, no way to separate sort of race, class, and labor organization.
Absolutely.
It's all living sort of from the same groups.
That's my argument. Yeah, absolutely.
And what makes St. Louis a good place to look at these issues?
Well, to be honest, I initially began my study of the civil rights movement in St. Louis because it was convenient.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, oftentimes
scholars
don't always admit this, but sometimes part of how you come about your work is in some ways the location.
Mm-hmm.
I was politically involved in St. Louis as well as pursuing my MA in history. And I wanted to understand a bit more about the politics, generally defined, electoral protest politics in the city that I was living in,
or
I was living in the St. Louis metropolitan area. As I got further into my research, though, I began to understand that St. Louis was not just simply a convenient backdrop for a narrative about the civil rights movement, but that St. Louis also matters in the sense that St. Louis historically had been a transition zone, a gateway, if you will, between the East and the so-called Western frontier. And I use frontier in quotes because there were people in the West, but you understand what I mean. It was known as the gateway to the West. But St. Louis also functioned as a transition zone between the culture, the economies, the race relations of the North and the South. And so my investigations and my reading that of what other scholars had done long before me was that St. Louis was a city that condensed very, I would say, diverse regional experiences. And so, as one scholar argued, it was a laboratory where the conflicting modes of race relations met and clashed. And so for me, it became this place to think about and study the diversity of race relations, the diverse ways that racism was manifested, and the diverse ways in which Black communities had fought back in one city. It's an overstatement because it's unique. So, you know, but St. Louis and cities like it, Baltimore, Maryland, Louisville, Kentucky, exist in this kind of zone, stemming from their role in the Civil War as areas where slavery existed, but yet these were states that did not succeed from the Union, mm-hmm. because slavery wasn't the dominant mode of economic relations in those states, and so they have this really interesting kind of quality. When I was living in the St. Louis area, and I would ask native St. Louisans where they would situate St. Louis regionally, the responses were often very different. So there were some people who would say the Midwest, mm-hmm. and you could certainly make an argument economically in terms of the ethnic diversity historically of the white population. But there are a number of folks who said, well, St. Louis is actually just a southern town. And part of the argument that I make in the book is that to some extent, they're kind of both right. Mm-hmm. And that's what makes it, I think, a unique place.
When I started working on a project last year with our entire news team about the protests here at Mizzou, I started thinking, you know, why Missouri for Ferguson? Why Missouri for Concerned Student 1950? And then the more I looked at the history of Missouri, I was like, of course, Missouri. It's sort of the perfect geographic center of all these different issues of race and class and migration. It all comes together here.
And space.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, part of the story of Ferguson is the story of the regional fragmentation of the St. Louis area and all the, which is a very, very curious, complicated thing to study and all the dynamics of that. And so in some ways, Ferguson reflected a situation that we're seeing in many other metropolitan areas around the nation, where you have the migration of racialized poverty from the central cities to the older inner ring suburbs. And so part of the argument that I would make is that in some respects, what happened in Ferguson could have happened anywhere. But it's not entirely coincidental that it happened in Ferguson, because I think the dynamics we see in Ferguson represent in some ways the leading edge of developments that we're seeing elsewhere. And mind you, and one has to be careful how much you read into this, because I do believe that history is about sometimes coincidence, you know. But the next major conflagration occurred in Baltimore, Maryland, another border state, border South city. So it's hard to see both of those things and then the University of Missouri-Columbia, which of course was an effect of people who had been involved in the Ferguson struggle or what have you, coming to campus. So here you have this period that demonstrates how Missouri historically has been a bellwether for where the nation might be heading.
This is Intersection on KBIA 91.3 FM. And today we're talking with University of Kansas professor Clarence Lang about race, organized labor, civil rights, and why Missouri is such important ground for study.
Another thing that your writing explores is how our sort of collective consciousness of the civil rights movement and what it was is this lens through which we see current protests, but that might not actually be helping us understand what's going on. Could you talk a little bit about
that? Yes, this is the second. Thank you for asking that. That question. This is a book I published 2 years ago, Black America in the Shadow of the 60s. And it really is an exploration of this idea. As someone who grew up the child of baby boomers, who grew up in the 80s, the late 80s, when the 60s moved from being history to mythology,
Right.
And you sort of seeing the Eisner Prize documentary series.
We don't understand it firsthand. It's already been processed for us in a way.
And it had become myth.
Mm-hmm.
And always sort of hearing from my elders just how fantastic a time that was, how that was a time like no other, and how that on the one hand shaped my research interest because I grew up with an intense interest in the 1960s, everything from reading the autobiography of Malcolm X as a 14-year-old to watching the Eisner Prize documentary series on the Civil Rights Movement in that same period in the late 1980s. And then later, as a scholar, but also as someone who had political involvement, sort of beginning to question how our popular memories of the 1960s, not necessarily what happened, but how we've come to understand that period, how that could be in some ways an obstacle to our own creative political thinking today, and forgetting the fact that generation that grew up in the 60s, like all generations have to do, you figure out the moment that you inhabit and you engage it on those terms, even though you look back to the past. I'm a historian, so I wouldn't denigrate my profession by saying that history doesn't matter. Obviously it does, but it informs the present, but ultimately we have to confront the times in which we exist. And that argument came to me at a moment where a lot of people in the media, and I'm not saying this to bash the media because there's plenty of that going on, but I think a lot of journalists were very quick, and frankly, a lot of the activists who were involved were very quick to reach back to the 60s as a model for what they might be doing in the present. So, for example, and I've seen some of this even on the campus where, you know, where I am, the University of Kansas, of understanding social movements as simply protest, when in fact there was a lot more that went into the creation and the sustaining of those movements than simply mobilizing people for demonstrations. There was also a great deal of organizing that occurred between those moments. I guess what I'm saying is one of the things that I in the book and in my own thinking and practice try to push back against is the idea that Black people in the 1960s existed in a constant state of revolt. That was a period of revolt, mind you, but the politics of that period were more complex than simply that. And we have to think about how we develop and put forward equally nuanced, take nuanced approaches to the circumstances that we confront.
Do you think in terms of how the civil rights era, not actually what it was, but how we've mythologized it and how we think of today with this focus on the action sort of leaves by the wayside the longstanding institutions that allowed the actions to happen, like the Black churches, like organized labor?
That's right. Yes. And I think that one of the things that I try and talk about in the book on St. Louis, or one of the things I try to provide, is a sense of the daily lives and institutions. I mean, the book is primarily focused on social movement activism, but you can't tell that story without giving readers a sense of the longstanding institutions that made that happen.
Mm-hmm.
And this is really interesting because I think one of the challenges, I would say, as someone who writes and teaches on African American history, is that one of the consequences of the post-70s period was the collapse of many Black institutions, not simply due to integration, if you will, but also economic crisis, which had an impact on the ability to sustain Black newspapers, Black civic organizations, certainly has created hardship for Black churches, even though you now have the emergence of these mega churches, which is, I'm a little concerned about that, you know, in terms of the water set that takes people into. But all of these organic grassroots institutions, I think, were very hit hard with the economic transformations and our political discourse about what we valued in our economy after the 1970s. And so part of the task, I think, and this is why I really, you know, part of my argument in the second book is about thinking about social movements more than just sort of the sexy stuff of placards and demonstrating mm-hmm. and what have you, but also that sustained community and institution building work. Now, the flip side is that social media, I think, has become a really interesting space.
This is Intersection on KBIA 91.3 FM. And today we're talking with University of Kansas professor Clarence Lang.
I was thinking when we were talking about the Black churches and then social media and these spaces where organization can happen and be maintained, that there's also sort of like an age aspect, a generational mm-hmm. aspect to that. Mm-hmm. Like if you look at Martin Luther King or a lot of the people yeah. who were at the forefront of civil rights, those were young or middle-aged people, right?
Very young.
But were they as young as the people who we see like at the
Martin
forefront of protests?
Oh, I see your point. Well, let me start with this. I mean, I think that for example, Martin Luther King Jr. was only 39 when he was assassinated. Now, maybe for some of your readers, you know, 39 is young to me at
yes.
this point.
No,
right?
It is young to me too.
Malcolm X, they were both under 40.
Gosh, I really thought that they were older when they were killed.
No. And in fact, you know, individuals, you know, Stokely Carmichael became Kwame Ture, Huey P. Newton. These individuals were all in their mid-20s.
Wow.
The average age of a member of the Black Panther Party, I've read, was somewhere in the area of 17 or 18 years old.
So they totally would have been using Facebook had it existed.
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely. And in fact, the Panthers, as an example, I mean, did have a Facebook of sorts. I mean, the newspaper, which, you know, right. that in addition to the stories, really traded in all these very rich visuals that were created by Emery Douglas, who did the illustrations. So movements are, youth, and that's always tricky to define where that ends, not
right.
so much where it begins, have always been pivotal to movements. But at their best, they're intergenerational. I mean, a good example of this, probably the best example, would be Ella Baker, mm-hmm. Who I believe was in her 40s, who was significantly older than many of the students that she played a very important role in inspiring and helping to mentor. So we don't want to make the mistake that sometimes occurs, and I know that 30 years ago I would have been in the same category of making this mistake, of assuming that there's nothing to learn from folks who've been around a little longer, because learning is not linear. And at their best, movements link generations. And I think that's something to keep in mind, too. Not that there's not struggle and contestation, but that there has to be a coming of everyone to the table.
You've also written about how sports are a mirror, is held up to society, whether society wants to see it or not. And I think we've definitely seen some of that, like with Colin. Kaepernick. Mm-hmm. That's caused a great amount of debate
yeah.
among people. And to me, that talks about, you know, it's not just about race, but it's about freedom of speech. Mm-hmm. It's about age. It's about how we think about sports figures and what they mm-hmm. should be doing.
Celebrity.
How have you been thinking about those things?
Well, this is really interesting because on my campus just a few weeks ago, my department and its Langston Hughes Center, which is centered in a department, were sponsors of a visit by Harry Edwards, who wrote this book, you know, The Revolt of the Black Athlete, who was involved in the protests at the 1968 Olympics in Mexico City. And I thought he was just a beautiful example of what you're talking about, who's someone who could talk about the current issues of the day and frame the role of sports as a lens through which to not just to see inequalities or dynamics of difference, race, class, gender, sexuality, but also as a place for mobilization. And we're in the midst of that right now. My argument would be not to take it away from sports, but I would say that cultural production more generally, whether you're talking about music, film, art, literature, recreation, sports, that anytime you have a strong social protest endeavor occurring, it becomes a magnet. And so everyone has to at least figure out where they are in relation to those dynamics.
This is Intersection on KBIA 91.3 FM. And today, we're talking with University of Kansas professor Clarence Lang. Clarence completed his undergraduate degree right here at MU. He told me about the beginnings of his activist consciousness decades ago at MU and about understanding Missouri's important place in ongoing national struggles over race.
And when you saw the Concerned Student 1950 protests in the fall, did you think, like, yes, I thought that this would happen someday, or this relates to my experience? Or was your experience, you know, 20 years ago quite different from that?
We didn't accomplish anything along the lines of what occurred here recently. So, no, I could not have imagined that. But when I saw what happened at the University of Missouri, I do remember saying to myself, this is going to spread. That I do remember. Is that I think that, you know, a threshold has been passed, and that show is going to go on the road. And you don't have to have a crystal ball to see that that was going to happen. And the question became, for a lot of us who are, you know, not in this region, were, do we go to Ferguson? Do we go to the University of Missouri? Or do Ferguson and Mizzou provide an opportunity for us to think about the circumstances right where we stand? And many of us answered with both, you know, coming in solidarity. I went to Ferguson, not to Mizzou, but also thinking about how do these issues, how do they matter where we are? So once again, sort of demonstrating how this region has been, you know, continues to be an important bellwether, certainly on issues of race and questions of citizenship and equality and inclusion and access. This is still a place that tells us a lot about where we are as a nation as a whole.
That was Clarence Lang, professor of African and African American Studies at the University of Kansas. Thank you for joining us here on Intersection, Conversations in Our Community. And of course, thank you to our guest, Clarence Lang, and our producers, Claire Banderas, Kelly Polachek, Colin Crabb, and Abby Ivory Gagne. If you want to listen to this show again, you can visit us online at kbia.org and find Intersection under the Shows tab. You can also follow us on Facebook to stay up to date with our show. Our music is Montana Skies. I'm Sarah Shariari for Intersection here on KBIA 91.3 FM.